This Bob Trake is bringing you the other side of the news. WCRS 98.3, 102.1. I'm in the studio with Free Press researcher Jerry Bello, who will have a new article out this Thursday. Well, actually, it's coming out Wednesday. Thursday's Thanksgiving. So Jerry will be doing stuff, as will the paper, in honor of Native American Heritage Month. But one of the things we're going to do is our continued coverage of Welcome to the Machine, how Columbus's political machine works. Welcome once again to the other side of the news, Jerry Bello.
Hey, thank you for having me over, Bob.
And again, many things have happened since the last time you were on. One of the key questions that the Free Press posed in a recent issue was, does money buy public policy in Columbus? And again, this was written by our friends over at the Columbus Coalition for Responsive Government, which I've worked with on and off. They recently submitted roughly 23,000 signatures, and they had enough to get a ballot initiative from the people approved. And a lot of this has to do with questions of where the money comes from in Columbus politics. Jerry, I know you saw the article that there was one super PAC, Friends of Ginther, that provided most of the money, 70% of the money, in the campaign of 2013 for city council members. In fact, A. Troy Miller only raised $7,000 of his own, but received nearly $59,000 from Friends of Ginther, and that is, of course, the city council president. And again, Eileen Paley was a recipient of a similar amount, and it looks like it has to be commercial for radio and TV time. So we moved away, at least in your article, from looking directly at the super PAC Friends of Ginther, and clearly this show and the paper would not be perceived as a friend of Ginther. And we looked at the mayor. What did you find out in looking at the mayor's campaign committee?
Well, the thing to realize about the mayor is he's not up for election right now. You know, he won in 2011. He's got a four-year term. He doesn't have to run again until 2015. But he collected a lot of money in 2012 and a lot of money in this year, 2013. He had a particularly good stretch that I called the 3 days in June this year, where he got $13,000 right after going to the annual conference of the U.S. Conference of Mayors.
And again, at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, who were the people? Other mayors? Who was giving what some consider mayor for life, Michael Coleman, the money for his political action committee?
Well, I can't see who the corporate attendees at that conference were, but what I can see is that a lot of the mayor's recent money comes from architecture firms, civil engineering firms, the lawyers that represent these firms. Where the money comes from unions, it is primarily from building trades unions. And other than that, Nationwide, Schottenstein, J.P. Morgan, and a few PACs. But even the banks, even the non-building trade unions, are minor donors compared to the big money. The large checks come from architecture and construction firms.
And what, if any, speculation do you have on that? Why would these type of firms be donating so much money to the mayor's reelection when he probably hardly needs the money in this overwhelmingly Democratic city?
Well, first of all, we don't even know that he's going to run in 2015. That's what's really, he hasn't announced his candidacy. It's not even open for him to file. I could speculate that people would like to win city contracts.
Well, that makes sense. And recently we've been talking about the massive redevelopment on the east side with Poindexter Village and the fact that those historic buildings look like they're coming down. So could be some massive redevelopment. We're not exactly sure what the plan is on the east side. Is it out of those type of activities you suspect that people, in hopes of doing the redevelopment, give money to the mayor or to the city council president?
Well, one announced contract winner is the architecture firm of Moody Nolan. And they gave more to the mayor after his reelection than before it.
Hmm. Okay, let's repeat this. Moody Nolan, who's the contractor for
Poindexter Village,
for the project there, the controversial project to knock down historical buildings at Poindexter Village, including, of course, 10 that were designated by a expert panel to be worthy of being saved for historical preservation. Those will be knocked down. The architect is Moody Nolan, and this year, which is not an election year, they gave more money than last year.
This year and last year. So they gave, in 2013 and 2012, they gave more money than 2011 and 2010. The mayor won his election in 2011. So post-election night 2011, they've given more money than the 2 years before election night 2011.
Mm. Again, there's an article this week. You're looking at the mayor's contribution, and we raised the issue of the destruction of historic buildings on the Near East Side, these brick buildings at Poindexter Village. And it just so happens that Moody Nolan, the architect on the project, has given more money this year and last than in to the run-up of the mayor's reelection year of 2011. That sounds like a story people need to tweet. But I've noticed that we haven't talked about your tweet this story, or maybe not, when you talked about the murky world between the intelligence community and social media in a recent issue of the Free Press. Should we be afraid of tweeting?
Well, the intelligence community already gets every tweet that you make. Now, people don't think of that as a problem because tweets are public, but that includes your deleted tweets, that includes your direct messages, everything. Because Twitter sells its entire database, and one of the people that buys it is Booz Allen Hamilton. If you look at the software analysis tools that the intelligence community is known to have, because they paid for their development pretty much openly, you can classify and categorize tweets by subject, time, place. You can look at influencers. For instance, there's a program that called Recorded Future that can go through a bunch of tweets and pull out all the references to time, and it can tell the difference between 3 a.m. today and 3 a.m. tomorrow. So I'll meet you at 3, Bob. And they can put all this together. You can have another program like Metacarta that can go through a set of documents, including tweets, and reference them to place and place names. You have another program called Tartan, which can look at a network of communications and pick out through content analysis the people in that network that aren't necessarily in charge, but are the major opinion leaders and influencers, the people that are actually driving and controlling the conversation, whether or not they're in command or in control. Having the intelligence community totally accessing all of Twitter's database all at the same time and running these tools, they can control and influence the public's conversation with itself, locally and globally.
So are you suggesting they could put in influential tweeters to guide debate and direction on the internet?
Not only could they do that, but they could know ahead of time who to follow and who to be followed by and who they have to influence and what networks that they have to do and who they have to oppose and who they have to bring along. And if you look at how things, I mean, right now we see Twitter as something associated with public conversation about celebrities, public conversation about pop culture, but without Twitter, you had no Arab Spring, period, the end. And if you look at Twitter's effect on social movements and how social movements talk to and about themselves through Twitter and realize the government's ability, one, to very, very, very carefully and automatically analyze Twitter on a certain subject, one, and then two, if you look at persona management software, which the government has, allowing a single person to be 30 people on the internet and automatically keep all their lies straight, have consistent backstory, have it all work, right? With, you know, 10 office workers pulling, you know, 8-hour shifts, you know, go into the office, they can know what to write, who to write it to, how to influence, and suddenly you've magnified them all by 30. And now you're magnifying everybody by 30. You're knowing who to talk to and where to inject yourself into the conversation. Your propaganda and your influence on a social movement becomes disproportionate. It's not just that the government's listening to our conversations about social justice, about change, about the world we want to live in, but they have the ability to very effectively speak. It's not government control in news media. When you look at government involvement in social media in terms of being social media creators, in terms of creating an echo chamber where all of a sudden it looks like everybody agrees with this bad idea and everybody goes along with it. This is interesting, and this is against freedom.
Hashtag be afraid. Be very afraid. I always wanted to say hashtag.
How about hashtag don't be afraid. Do it anyway. Do what's right. Don't listen to bad ideas just because everybody's talking about it. I mean, you should do things because they're the right thing to do, not because they're popular. Otherwise, if you do things because they're popular, go listen to Justin Bieber and don't bother me.
That's too long a hashtag. Hashtag 30 people just disagreed with Jerry. Oh, I forgot. It's only one.
It's only one. Yeah. Never mind.
Hashtag. They have 30. They're the Sybil of the internet. They've got 30 different personalities.
Right.
All kept in line, you're saying, by government software?
The software was written, at least one version was written by H.B. Gary, and this software will allow you to be consistent and have your message look like it's from the same persona over Twitter and Facebook and whatever other social media you're using, and then, okay, switch, I'm the next person. It all works together. All your lies are consistent. You just, it's like taking hats on and off and just pulling them off the wall.
Hashtag, this is the other side of the news. WCRS 98.3 102.1. This is Bob Fitrakis. I'm talking with Jerry Bello, the chief researcher for the Columbus Free Press. You can read him at freepress.org. Also, on the other side of the Free Press at freepress.com.
It's columbusfreepress.com, Bob.
Let me ask one of the 30 people. They'll tell me the correct one.
And send you straight to Detroit.
Okay, columbusfreepress.com. But it is freepress.org. So Jerry's got material on both sides. So what you're telling people is they need to go to Facebook.
No, I'm telling people to know who your Facebook friends are if you want to use it as a tool.
Hey, I've got 300 friends. I got them all in one day.
Yeah. Some conversations.
Everyone working the night shift at Fort Meade.
Some conversations should be had on Facebook. Some conversations should be had on a park bench. And some conversations should be had through a bullhorn. I mean, and some conversations should be had in a group of people discussing issues. I mean, your conversation should be appropriate to your into the medium that you're having it in and the people that you're having it with. Facebook allows us to be in touch with a lot of people and get instantly updated, but I wouldn't want, you know, people that I don't really know knowing what's on my mind. You know, there's this certain exhibitionism that goes with social media as a medium that is probably ill-advised.
So through these tools, through this use on Twitter, the use of this technology and Facebook and whatever other social media the government's using, they can actually help shape public policy debate and public opinion in the U.S.?
Absolutely. In fact, I believe that they are. I mean, it's not just Facebook or Twitter. Those are, I mean, my look at Twitter also looked at the involvement of the CIA in its recent IPO. And I looked at the involvement of the CIA in the recent purchase of the Washington Post by Jeff Bezos. But it's not just Twitter or Facebook, but for instance, on the freepress.org, and you know, we're going to be relaunching the site soon, and on the current site and on the new site, there will be no comments section. Because one, I don't have the time to moderate it, and two, more importantly, you can be a billion people in a comments section of a bunch of news sites and influence the debate that way by commenting and keeping your message consistent on every news site that runs or covers a story. And you can do that with multiple people and influence public policy that way, where it's not just that they're listening. Yeah, the NSA's listening, and yeah, that's got to stop. People have a right to privacy, whether or not they're political. But even more importantly, they're trolling. And when they're trolling, it's not just the NSA.
Are they also flaming?
Yes. Where that trolling is flaming, they troll, they flame, they listen, they shape the debate, and they decide ahead of time how and what they're going to do. And then when you're the intelligence community, you have marketing specialists, psychology PhDs, and every other known kind of person out there carefully selecting your language and carefully mm-hmm. keeping your workers on message. These are powerful tools. And we used to have laws about the government owning media in any way because of laws against propaganda. However, those laws, even when they were effective or followed, did not cover social media, did not cover the internet, and now that they're gone, it's even worse.
But there's limits, right? I mean, the government could say, let's make up a fantasy scenario. Say we were attacked by a terrorist. They attacked large buildings with planes. We couldn't then orchestrate a war. Say, I don't know, 17 of the 21 were from Saudi Arabia. None were from Iraq. The government wouldn't have the ability to essentially whip people into a frenzy over a country that had nothing to do with that attack and was under two-thirds no-fly zone, could it?
I believe that the government could do it without using social media, because social media was much younger when we decided to launch our totally useless war on Iraq.
They did that the old-fashioned way through TV. But now, I mean, would it be of value to have this new social media sending this stuff out?
Absolutely. I mean,
they couldn't manufacture a war like they did in 2003 through the social media, could they?
They nearly manufactured an invasion of Syria.
On the flip side, though, what about those that say, on the other hand, you wouldn't have had the Arab Spring without Twitter or Facebook?
Well, that's because Twitter and Facebook helped launch it, but those were things that were not as effectively censored by the secret police of the states that toppled. But by the same token, in the middle of the Arab Spring, new tools were developed for people in those countries to talk to each other and were deployed by those social movements. And those tools were not made by the United States government. Those tools were made by Anonymous.
Hmm. And what kind of tools were they?
Encrypted chats, ways for people to have group chats that were, one, encrypted, and two, secret. Ways for people, secret gateways so that people could bypass internet censorship to post outside of their country and give the rest of the world updates, ways to get video of atrocities out. This is, you know, the contribution of the global internet community into helping the Arab Spring. Twitter was one of many mediums, and it was essential for people to talk about what was going on right now. But to have a more in-depth conversation, there was assistance coming from all over the world to get the story out, to enable people to talk to each other securely, to confound and avoid the secret police agencies of all these repressive regimes.
Now, there's been some other stories you've been working on as well. You seem to have taken interest in the drone corridor here in central Ohio. What can you tell our listeners about our future as a drone corridor?
Well, it appears as though, despite citizen opposition, that southwestern Ohio and southeastern Indiana are going to be a national drone testing area. I believe that that's going to focus on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I believe that there's a large buy-in from the academic community, or maybe I should call it the higher education industry. It's supported. It's sort of a self-finance thing where the government is, through base relocation and closure money, financing citizen buy-in and industry relocation into this drone corridor. I think it's going to focus on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Wright State University, Sinclair College, and Springfield Municipal Airport.
Why? Why those three?
Well, Springfield Municipal Airport, I mean Wright-Patterson, because it's a major base, it's home to the Air Force University, it's home to the Air Force Materiel Command, it's home to Armstrong Aeromedical Laboratories, and it has, it's a major center of military learning. Sinclair Community College, because they host drone industry conferences and they have a license to operate drones. This is a community college.
Drone tech.
And then
career and technical specialties, including drone use.
And then Springfield Municipal Airport, because it's home to an Air National Guard unit that used to fly F-16s. Now, and then when they weren't flying F-16s, they were training pilots from foreign air forces in flying F-16s. They don't do that anymore. Now they're a drone base, an Air National Guard drone base. And I'd like to note that Springfield Municipal Airport is a Air National Guard base primarily because, and still is primarily because, it used to sit in the correct congressional district. The congressman prior to the one that's sitting now, his name escapes me, although I've been on the phone with him once. It wasn't a pleasant conversation. Was the deputy chair of the House Budget Committee. That whole airport, a local general aviation airport that really has no function other than recreational flying, being a military base capable of operating F-16s. The only reason why it had F-16s was when they got rid of the A-7, which they flew there previously, they moved the F-16s that were used in an air defense role from another Air National Guard unit at Atlantic City International Airport and move them to Ohio. You know, pure pork for an important congressman. Had those F-16s been in Atlantic City International Airport, New Jersey, in an air defense role, 9/11 could have been stopped cold, but our air defenses were in Ohio, not on the coast. So sorry, Manhattan.
All right, we've got to wrap up here in a minute or so, but I thought drones were out assassinating people in Yemen and destroying wedding parties in Afghanistan.
And
why would we need a drone zone in central Ohio?
Drones can watch you. Drones, I mean, you're thinking about big drones that are
basic. Predator drones.
Predator drones, yeah. Drones come in all shapes and sizes and capabilities. I can buy a small quad-rotor drone the size of a coffee table that could be equipped with a rifle for about $32,000, and all I'd have to do is go on the internet and click on add to cart and have a sufficient credit rating.
And I know there was one police unit that wanted it to shoot a automatic Benelli shotgun. It could go around sucking stuff up and have a shotgun. But that's for another show, Mr.
There's a
Bello.
Guy in Kentucky who installed an AK-47 on one and put it on YouTube.
All right.
It's easy.
Okay, next time we'll talk a little more about the future of automatic weapons and the drone zone in central Ohio. Thanks for being on the other side of the news, Jerry Bello.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
We're gone.